Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. Thanks again for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you enjoy what we do, please like, comment, and share in your favorite podcast app, and we'll keep sharing great conversations like the one we have for today. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. I'm also an investor in and advisor to more than 30 AI-first startups, and as you know, a firm believer in the power of technology to make humans better. If you're passionate about changing the world with AI, or maybe just looking for your next adventure, let's talk. Now, we learn from AI thought leaders weekly on this show. And of course, the added bonus is you get one AI fun fact each week. Today's fun, or maybe in today's case, gloomy and dystopian fact is this. An article published this week in the Bureau of Investigative Journalism by Neon McIntyre, along with others, details the trauma experienced by 42,000 TikTok content moderators in Colombia who are paid, $10 US per day to screen TikToks that frequently consist of just vile, hateful, inappropriate content and images. They view it so your kids don't. But who's looking out for their well-being? TikTok, famous for its AI-based personalization algorithms that generate just narcotic-like, addictive feeds, actually relies on humans to screen and label content. Many don't realize that. The mental health impact of content moderation work has been well documented through the work of companies like Facebook, now Meta, Twitter, etc. Not surprisingly, moderators frequently report depression, anxiety, sleep loss. Workers getting paid what really amounts to slave labor wages shouldn't also be required to perform tasks that dehumanize them. As a community of technologists who care about people, we can do better. This is one of many disturbing intersections between AI, the future of work, and ethics that we'll be discussing in the weeks ahead. As always, we'll link to the full article in today's show notes, but I thought this was an important one to share with all of our listeners. Now, shifting to this week's conversation, which is certainly less dystopian, generative AI is not just the hottest investment theme of 2022, but it's also the future of content creation. Use text or voice prompts to generate images with services like DALL-E 2 and Stable Diffusion have captured imaginations, but also introduced new ethical considerations and concerns about intellectual property ownership. Will AI make photographers, artists, and copywriters obsolete, or maybe inspire a new generation of creators and lead to new forms of artistic impression? It's unclear at this point, but this is shaping up to be one of the most consequential dialogues of our generation because it forces us to reconsider what it means to be human in an age when algorithms perform human tasks increasingly better than we can. Well, I'm thrilled to have today's guest with us. He's the founder and CEO of Visual, the company pioneering the use of generative AI to create synthetic stock media. All of those photos you see online and in print publications of people promoting products usually are human models posing in generic ways. Their pictures are sold by companies like Getty Images and marketplaces that are oftentimes inefficient, hard to maintain, and quite limited in scope. Michael and his partner, Nico, are legends in the world of stock media who realized there's a better way. They created what they call an algorithmic camera and launched Visual last year to scratch their own itch. Michael's a serial entrepreneur and also a photographer based in Budapest, and he's out to test the limits of generative AI. And without further ado, Michael Osterreiter, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Let's get started by having you share a little bit more about your background and how you got into this space.
Sure. Hi, Dan. Welcome, everybody. So, well, I'm a photographer, of course, and a content creator by heart. So my whole life, I tried to create whatever, text, images, videos, animations. It's just content in my head, which has to get out somehow. And one of my earliest memories, which led me later on to generate visual content, is I listened to an awful lot of music, usually metal, thrash metal, black metal, death metal, with headphones on the school bus. And I had my images and movies going on in my head, which I wanted to always share. I wanted others always to participate in my visual mind, so to say. So I don't have a tech background, but I got into visual media quite early. I'm in this industry since about 20 years now. And when you produce visual media in a commercial context in the IP licensing sphere, of course, you need to be economic in what you do. You need to optimize your production workflow. You need to keep costs down. You want to maximize creativity. You need to amplify your creative horizon, what you can reach with a limited budget, and how many content gaps you can fill in the commercial industry in order to achieve the maximum of revenue or creativity when it comes down to art. So I saw the uprising of generative AI since many, many years before I really started to engage. I perceived it more as a research project, which lacks in quality and reliability for many, many years. But at one moment, of course, it slowly reached the threshold of commercial usability. And at first, the idea to generate visual media via AI was for me, of course, a bit challenging, like it is for many creative people around the globe right now. It was an interesting idea to outsource the actual creative process, the actual neural activity to a machine. On the other hand, it is an optimization of workflow. It keeps costs down, it amplifies the creative horizon, and it is a massive opportunity, of course. It showed a massive opportunity. So usually when you work in any industry for more than a decade, you see the evolution of the industry. And especially in our time, it comes with lots of innovation, lots of changes. Film photographers in the old stock media industry saw the upcoming of microstock photography and faced sudden huge amount of competition. Then smartphones came in, and professional digital photographers had been a bit pissed off by the competition, by the new ample horizon. And it is clear that you cannot avoid the evolution of an industry or technological evolution in human history. You have to follow it up. So I took up the challenge. I investigated. I started to play around with the code. I do not have a professional tech background, but I was always a bit into coding. I was always a bit nerdy. I always investigated and discovered new technologies. And I was quite baffled how the results came out, and for me at least, how easy it was to adapt the code, even with massive changes. So I took up the challenge and founded Visual and decided to leave the organic content production. Essentially, I stopped being a photographer and stopped expressing my own creativity through my hands, through a camera, through 3D software, or whatever it is I used before, and focused on AI. And here we come also already to the next interesting subject, which is the ethical and legal use of AI technology in generative media. So one of the first things which caught my attention was the use of datasets or scraped datasets, EEA, most likely dirty datasets, as we call it. These dirty datasets consist of images, artworks, photographs, biometric data, EEA, images of humans, and so on, which got used and scraped without permission of the copyright holders, without permission of the subjects which are depicted in the images, and without anything else. And of course, in the research sphere, that is okay if you just want to prove the functionality of one algorithm. However, I come from the commercial sphere. I come from the visual commercial media sphere. And in that industry, you cannot publish in an advertising or commercial context any image of an identifiable human subject without permission. Usually, when I uploaded photo shoots of real people, you need a model release. You need a written contract which gives you permission to use the image of that person in literally any context, apart from journalism, editorial, and documentary or private context. And I was quite stunned how reckless the research sphere handles personal data and copyright data, of course. So I looked into that, and it was for a long while a very tough question for me, which way to go with that. How should I approach that subject? And the CTO in me obviously was tempted to just use any data available to download that 2 million images dataset from GitHub somewhere or whatever is out there and just use that and take a shortcut. But my ethical self did not quite agree with that. And also I saw a value in having genuine and legally and ethically clean data in the industry. So we decided with my co-founder, Nicolas Meniches, to generate our own data sets in studio. So apparently we are used to create a huge amount of data, visual data in studio. We had the production pipeline, we had the equipment, we had the knowledge. So we started to shoot people in studio. We designed the data set for machine learning purposes for generative AI. We have now over 500,000 images, original images, in our human biometric data set, which is also available for licensing, of course, for third parties. And I'm quite happy, meanwhile, with that decision. What we see as of now is the maturing of the AI industry coming out of the research sphere and into the commercial sphere, into proper companies. And that is a maturing process for the lawmakers, for the jurisdictions, because they need to assess the situation. And various jurisdictions assess the situation differently. And also the companies who engage into that, how they want to approach that subject ethically and legally, if they want to comply with the rules and how many shortcuts they want to take. So unfortunately, what we see now with some companies still think they can scrape any data available on the net, which could be potentially legal in the US under fair use. In other jurisdictions, definitely not. And in other jurisdictions, definitely yes. It depends on what we are talking about. But in principle, from a moral point of view, and that's my personal point of view, we witness the biggest art heist in history right now. The biggest art theft in history right now. Because most of the artists do not get compensated as of right now. And I make a small stop here and leave some room for questions, because otherwise I talk endlessly.
Michael, that was the most thorough introduction ever. you answered many of my questions in a lot of detail, but I'm going to rewind the tape and dig into a few topics that you teased there. So sure. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the stock media economy, just talk us through, how does it work? You know, where do those images that we see online come from? Who sells them? Who owns them? Starting there.
Sure. Since the time of MicroStock, since the rising of MicroStock in about 2003, 2004, it started to get interesting. Virtually anybody can upload SRS content to stock media agencies. Of course, the content creator needs to have full permission to upload that content, meaning he needs to own full copyright and have full permissions and comply with various legal restrictions and obligations. So in any image a content creator uploads for commercial usage to any stock media agency, there cannot be any recognizable human use of model release, as mentioned. There cannot be any trademark, certain designs of buildings, of cars, illumination of paintings are copyrighted, of course. So it has to be 100% legally clean content. So there cannot be a can of Coca-Cola in the image, or a car of Volkswagen, or anything which is kind of protected. That is absolutely necessary, of course, to offer that material for commercial usage. And on the client side, anybody who is aware of copyright and runs a professional business and wants to publish any image in a commercial context would be a potential client for stock media images.
So picking up from there, I want to understand a little bit more about how you solve this problem with generative AI. And specifically, I'm familiar with using DALL-E or DALL-E 2 or Stable Diffusion, where you enter a text prompt and then using a massive image library that those services have amassed, it will generate images from text. for what Visual does, you mentioned bringing humans into a studio and making that your kind of your corpus, the data set that you generate incremental stock photos from. Talk us through how you use generative AI versus what probably a lot of our listeners are familiar with in something like DALL-E 2.
I mean, sites like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney are pretty advanced, of course. I do not agree from an ethical point of view of the use of data. And also, they are kind of what I call advanced research projects which penetrates commercial space as of now, meaning the output is not necessarily stable. When you try out, for example, a Stable Diffusion model, the latest I tried out was 1.4, if I remember correctly, the content can be still super messy. And art is obviously a good term to camouflage all types of shortcomings of photorealism. So the output is not necessarily realistic. It comes out lots of nonsense still. And we in Visual aim to get photorealistic content out there, which is indistinguishable from real photography. And also based on legally clean and ethically clean data.
So let's say if I go into DALL-E 2 and I ask for an African-American female aged 35 to 40 cheering at a football game. I haven't tried that prompt, but presumably DALL-E 2 would give me something interesting, maybe not photorealistic, I don't know what, but talk me through what Visual is doing and why that would be a better approach than if I wanted to use like that image, let's say in a marketing campaign, I would prefer to use Visual than DALL-E 2.
DALL-E 2, I do not know where the data comes from, what is the underlying data set of OpenAI. I cannot comment on that, of course. I do not know the quality exactly. DALL-E 2 is probably the one I least played around with on the net as of now, although we have API access to DALL-E 2. But still, the concept is the same. It's an advanced research project. It's maturing quickly as the content gets more and more realistic. But still, it's not tailored for commercial photorealism and 100% reliability. What our customers value of Visual is specifically that it's commercially greenlighted, that we comply with the various legislations, that we comply with the GDPR legislation, we comply with handling of personal data with the various various US legalities and so on. And we are totally transparent regarding that. Each of our subjects, of course, signs this contract. We license a data set, and usually we talk to bigger companies who want to be on the legal secure side, on the legally secure side. Then, of course, we narrow our generative AI as of now down to humans. That will not remain forever like that. But right now we limit it to photorealistic humans, which gives us a possibility to do a relatively good job for our limited funding right now. We try to cover as much variety of ethnicities, of emotions, of expressions, of human appearance as we can. And we want to tailor it really for commercial usage and make organic photo shoots obsolete in that sense.
So I want to understand this a little bit more. So in the studio, let's say you photograph an Eastern European 43-year-old female with a straight face, no expression. And then potentially a client using Visual says, I want a 40 to 45 year old Eastern European female smiling, waving her hands. Just give me an example of like that extension of an actual photo that you've taken. What are the possibilities? Could you extend, someone with a straight face to smiling or laughing or waving her hands, or what's the art of the possible?
We cover already most emotional expressions, crazy expressions, serious, joyful expressions, and text them accordingly to make the algorithm understand what human emotions look like, as well as other attributes, of course. Now coming down to waving, we started now to shoot our dataset on video, full body postures, full body expressions, on 120 frames per second, and 4K video. So we cover that also very soon, and we try to have the most complete biometric data set available, which is standardized.
So 120 frames per second, you're generating a massive volume images. What's the process for labeling these thousands, tens of thousands, millions of images?
we train a inverted clip model to automize tagging and labeling, of course, of the images. It's relatively easy. The first batch we do manually. We do that also since many years because stock media, of course, needs a manual labeling or partially manual labeling. There are various tools around AI-based or classic algorithm-based or extractive models as well. So we do the first batch on our standardized set of tags. And then we train a clip prefix model on set data to tag automatically.
So as an example, if in the data set there's, let's say, a Indian woman waving her hands, and I want, you know, the Eastern European woman who wasn't photographed waving her hands, but to wave her hands, then because the photo of the Indian woman was waving her hands, you could infer that and combine the two to create the Eastern European woman waving her hands. Is that, I know this is a very, very simplistic example, but is that the kind of thing you might be able to generate?
Yes, of course. I mean, the neural algorithm understands the image in itself to a certain degree. There might be similarities sometimes to the original posture or the original humans, because it's kind of a transformer technology to a certain degree. You see that in stable diffusion also, when you generate, for example, an image in stable diffusion, where there's very little data, original data available, it might look similar to an existing person. For example, you can type in stable diffusion already a real person's name and generate, for example, Elon Musk holding hands with, I don't know, Robert Downey Jr. or somebody, and can generate an image like that. So it's a kind of a transformative way, and it may contain parts of the original image, and our model release covers even that. We could even publish the original data set in a commercial context and would have full permission by contract to do so. So we really made sure that we are covered by all possible ways.
So one of the things that's captured the imagination of the public about generative AI systems, like I keep going back to Stable Diffusion or DALL-E too. I know there are many others, but it's the ability to combine natural language, a natural language text prompt, with this massive. So I'm a non-artist, I'm a non-photographer, and I can generate these incredibly sophisticated images just with a broad range of natural language text prompts. But it sounds like from what you described, you know, specifically focused on photorealistic human images, I'm bounded by the kinds of labels that I use in my text prompt. If I ask for a woman cheering and nothing has been labeled cheering, how broad of a use of natural language can be accommodated if there's not a direct match between what I ask for and what the labels contain?
Of course, it depends, as you noted correctly, how many tags are in the dataset to make it understand better. We are limited with our labeling as of now. We do that also consciously to block misuse, for example, to block abuse or defamatory cases and these things. So we bind it as of right now, not to a real language, not to a real natural language model, but to a standardized label set. We also train on natural language the models and experiment with that. But as of now, we feel more comfortable to, especially since our data set is limited, to narrow it down to standardized labels and its similarities and its and its synonyms and so on in the language model, of course.
But eventually, not to put words in your mouth, but you could use like an LLM to be able to look at similar terms, or you use some kind of NLP techniques to be able to fan out, you know, I say cheering and cheering a bunch of synonyms, and those could be used as well. Now, shifting to one of the things I really liked about your intro is the focus on adhering to copyrights and making sure copyright holders are paid royalties. So like in this very simple, overly simplistic case I gave where you're combining two images of females into one new one, do both of those human females whose photos were used to generate the third get some kind of a royalty when you sell me the generated version of that combines the two of them?
The subjects in the dataset get paid, of course. They get initially paid, and it's a one-time payment because it's impossible to track that and trace that down. So that is very important, of course. And also, we also are working on various legal agreements with big stock agencies to leverage the data of stock media agencies to train our generalist models. So we are not limiting ourselves to synthetic humans. We want to cover everything, just as most of the other generative models. We just want to do it in an ethical way. So we talk to stock agencies, which will most likely provide us with hundreds of millions of images to train our AI. And in this scenario, the original copywriter, the original photographer who uploaded his image to the stock agency gets a royalty split actually from the generated content. It's a bit fuzzy because it's a percentage-based model to calculate that, of course, but we want to make sure that the original copyright holder gets a compensation. We also have to extend that a bit because we also get requests from known artists to train a specific generative model on a portfolio of one specific artist who also gets a royalty split on that and actually owns the trained model set. To extend his creativity.
So Visual would generate the data set and provide an exclusive license.
We receive the whole portfolio of one very well-known artist and train one AI on his portfolio exclusively. And the artist will own then the rights to this trained model. And all revenue derived will be shared based on a royalty split.
I know with Getty Images and other stock photo galleries, they watermark the images and there's some kind of digital rights management platform to ensure appropriate use of content. Does Visual offer that today?
Appropriate use of content in what context? Do you mean the data sets or synthetic media?
Yeah, so if you generate content, license it exclusively to your client, how do you prevent the misuse of it? DRM, digital rights management, how do you prevent it from being copied and misused by others online?
Mm-hmm. We try to comply with the content authenticity initiative also. Now, the copyright of the outcome is not different to any other image on the internet. And the copyright, how an AI-generated image gets treated copyright-wise, depends on the jurisdiction. I think, especially in the US, there have been few precedent cases where the court said, essentially, AI-generated content cannot be copyrighted. So that is one factor. However, that is in the US only. How other jurisdictions assess that, it will depend. We have to see. And also on the other side, we get paradox information because I'm aware that one artist got the copyright for a AI-generated image in New York, I think he was based. So I do not know the background of these legalities. To be honest, in that context, I rely on so jurisdictions have to figure out how they treat that subject of AI-generated content. And here we get also, we penetrate another subject, how an AI by itself gets treated by the jurisdictions. Is it an entity? Is it not an entity? Will it be assumed that an AI can be genuinely creative or not? Is it a derivative work of the original data set or not? Now, if we tailor the data set to a specific concept, if you design a data set for a specific generative model, is the outcome then copyrighted because it's a derivative or not? There are many questions still in the room which have to be cleared, and each country on the planet has a different point of view on that.
We talk a lot about the ethics of AI on this show, and one of the hot topics in generative AI circles is who is responsible if generative AI is used to produce, let's say, hateful works of art. Let's say I could easily input a text prompt like Joe Biden burning the Bible, and it would look very realistic. And I could then go and share that online. And obviously there could be, you know, adverse consequences. Who's responsible? Is it the owner of the generative AI model, or is it the user who generated that image from the text prompt?
Mm-hmm. Sure. That is exactly a great example why we limit our prompts to certain predefined tokens to prevent misuse of that type. However, having said that, I think AI is just another tool for content creators to use. So I don't think a producer of image manipulation software, for example, can be held responsible if one individual Photoshops, for example, together Joe Biden in whatever context or generates an image which is in whatever way offensive or defamatory or misleading or whatever. There's still always a human behind that generation. And I don't think the tool can be held responsible for the use uh, for what it is used by as a creator, as a content creator. So I think it's still, you're still in the area that a human is ultimately responsible for the use of the tool. And we actually will fix that in our licensing agreement also, in our usage agreement.
We just recently had a fascinating conversation on the show with a Harvard professor named Jonathan Frankel, who is helping author a lot of key policy legislation, including we were discussing the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, what should the role be of regulation, whether it's the federal level, state level, international, et cetera, when it comes to regulating questions like this? What's your perspective on what's the right role for regulatory frameworks, and how do you see the role of policy influencing or constraining maybe innovation in the next few years?
That is a very interesting question. I mean, if you want to hear my personal opinion, I think policymakers and governments have to level up tremendously in their understanding of what content is, how it can be misleading, how the internet works, how technology works. There are still huge knowledge gaps present in governments. They fail to assess that question since many years. Also, the basic, very basic copyright questions are not answered as of today. I spoke just yesterday, I spoke with a very well-known copyright lawyer in the US based in New York. And she told me it took, in one case, 13 years to settle a copyright theft case, which is kind of ridiculous. So they need to level up their whole understanding. And I think the whole sphere of copyright needs to be copyright of privacy and data usage, data mining. The whole concept would need to be revamped. Now, that's not going to happen, of course. Governments are slow. They're not necessarily understanding of technologies. Their understanding of technology is not necessarily so deep. We will see how it plays out. And it's a very hairy question. Because it's a very new scenario we have here with generative AI. You asked me previously who is responsible if one generative model gets used to generate something very disgusting, ugly, misleading, false information, whatever it is. And we will see that definitely a lot in the future. So personally, in the first place, I would not feel well publishing a generative model which can cover those things. I would like to restrict it. We also are in contact with lots of business partners, and some of them signed agreements with some companies which have non-restrictive generative models, and they run into lots of trouble even drafting up the legal agreement. Who is responsible? What can we do? Can we involve that in our site or not? And there are lots of questions still to answer. Now, personally, as mentioned, I would completely restructure the whole design of how the law addresses these issues. But these fundamental changes will not happen. So I cannot tell you how it will evolve. I think it will be a step-by-step evolution. We will see cases of abuse, of misuse. We will see precedent cases in whatever direction. And slowly, it will shape up. I also believe that the evolution of AI is way too quick as of now for governments to catch up. I mean, talking about visual generative models, that's one thing. There is a certain risk involved, but it's not the biggest risk. When it comes down to natural language models, for example, to text generators, I think there it gets a bit more dangerous because these models can have a massive power over the human mind. Seeing an image is one thing, but it always needs to be accompanied with a certain message. And generative models pose a threat to how we think as humans, how we perceive reality, how we distinguish reality from fake, so to say, from non-truth. And it will we will have to learn as humans to find our place in this new world. I wrote an extensive white paper regarding that with Ashish Jayman from Microsoft, where it goes into the psychological effects also of how humans form their picture of reality, what they see, how they assess reality. And it contains, for example, a long part that humans are used to take visual media as a proof of something. maybe in court, talk a photograph or something is kind of evidence. And when you caught somebody on camera, it was kind of evidence. And all that will be invalid within a few years.
Michael, as these questions about the right role of policy take shape, I want you to have a seat at the table when the tech community is represented. I really like that. That was a very thoughtful answer. Now, unfortunately, we're about out of time. This one flew by. And thank you for letting me go completely off script, by the way. But sure. I'm not letting you go without answering one last question. So you talked about humans and human representation of humans, and that kind of forms the basis of your thesis, your white paper, which I will link to in the show notes. But a broader question for you, as we increasingly are able to, let's say, you know, call it print digital humans, we can introduce new images of humans. We can make them say whatever we want. We can make them sound however we want them to sound. We can introduce clips of dead celebrities into movies, incredibly sophisticated ways of, you know, reanimating people and generating new humans that never existed. What does it mean to be a human in an era when we can digitally print humans that are not just photorealistic, but indistinguishable from what we traditionally call a human being?
Yeah, that's a very fun question, actually. It is a very interesting angle because I never saw it from that point of view. For me, in the advertising world, everything is fake anyways. Like, if you see an advertising of a family, it's not the real dad who comes up with makeup in a perfect outfit at 6 a.m. in the morning, bringing coffee to his family or whatever. It's all fake anyways, you know, and you get used to it. What we are as humans, if you want to go really profound on that question, you have to ask yourself, what is human consciousness? What is it? Can it be replicated? What does it represent? And there, you would have to go very, very, very deep. And I never saw it as a threat to the self-definition of human identity. I never perceived it as a threat to it, because you are human. You have a certain consciousness. You have a data set also, just as a AI algorithm. Your brain is kind of a neural network trained on a massive data set since you have been born. You trained your brain on that, and the neural algorithm is not that much different. But still, the spark of human consciousness is unique to you as of now. So now we do not know where the journey goes regarding AI. There are various theories how human consciousness is defined, what it is exactly. So when I was younger, I thought human consciousness arises simply out of a certain amount of informational complexity in a neural network. Pattern recognition in loops, in fractal cascades, reaches at some point a level of self-observation which makes us believe that we are conscious. Like, I thought that for a long while in my lifetime. I changed my perspective after many years, and I think it has more to do with the proto-consciousness theory. I think there is some kind of raw matter of consciousness in the universe which just gets funneled in organic structure. When you look at plants, for example, even microbes can react to certain stimuli. So microbes do not have a neural network. Plants do not have a neural network, still can process information and react to information. So I think awareness as such, I do not even want to call it consciousness. It might be that a certain amount of awareness funneled into a neural network generates consciousness and self-awareness at some point in this neural network. But I think the root of consciousness must be something else, and not just informational complexity trapped in a neural network. So that is a very fundamental question. And for me, the journey as of now is extremely exciting, actually, because if the AI, if any AI will form what is called singularity, I don't agree with the term, but will form real consciousness at some point, it will prove that consciousness is a product of informational complexity or not. And the third question, of course, might be that we are not even able to distinguish. It might be that an AI acts and behaves like a real human, and we will never be able to assess if it's actually conscious or not, because it imitates human behavior to such a degree that it's impossible to prove otherwise. So that's my take on that. Thanks.
I mentioned at the top of the conversation, this is a dialogue that's going to define our generation. And clearly we're just getting started. We're not even sure what the right questions to ask are. But I think to your point, defining what it means to be conscious, or in the popular press, we've heard the term sentient a lot in the context of the Google bot gone wrong and Blake Lemoyne and some of what happened with Lambda. But I think that's just the popular press's way of articulating that we're all a little bit confused. And I liked your answer. And I hope that as the conversation evolves, maybe you'd come back and we'll have the next version of this conversation.
Sure. Anytime.
Good. Well, Michael, before I can let you go, where can listeners learn more about you and the work that you're doing at Visual?
We want to revolutionize content as a world of content creation at Visual in a commercial context. You can always check us out on visual.com. You can get in touch with me on under michael@visual.com. Of course, I'm happy for any approach, any questions to answer, and any outreach, or if you want to cooperate with us, just get in touch.
We're all looking forward to seeing you succeed. You're doing great work, and really enjoyed getting to know you more and learning more about your vision. But thanks for joining us.
Perfect. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, gosh, that's all the time we have. It's such a thought-provoking conversation. But as always, I'm your host, Dan Turchin of AI and the Future of Work. We'll be back next week with another fascinating guest.